today in Studio 360?
I realized I was a grown-up when I was too old to enroll in space camp.
Generation X is all grown up.
I realized I was a grown-up when I could make my own grits.
And the actress Martha Plimpton says she's still a little freaked out by the idea.
One of the few things that scares me that I haven't done in recent years is make money.
For the Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction writer Juno Diaz, it's hard enough just being an artist.
If there was like a rowboat, the first person who gets thrown the hell off, you know, the doctor looks at the lawyer looks at the politician, and they're all like, throw that damn artist off, you know?
And singer-songwriter Josh Ritter isn't ready to give up his youth just yet.
When you realize you're not a child is when you realize that you have to protect that part of you, you know.
He opens his eyes, falls in love at first sight.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, live from New York, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and welcome to this special live show at WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space in New York City. Back in the early 1980s, I saw Tom Stoppard's brand new play, The Real Thing, on Broadway. If you don't know it, it's about a successful, angsty, middle-aged writer who's been married a long time and has a teenage daughter. At the time, it seemed fine. Okay, it's Tom Stoppard. But it didn't really speak to me. I was in my 20s. I was freshly married. I was full of my own youthful exuberance. I didn't have any children. I also had a slight issue with the title of the play. Just a couple of years earlier, I'd published my first book, a little collection of humorous essays called, as it happens, The Real Thing. When I published my The Real Thing, I was cut some serious slack because I was young at the time. Although in the book, I knew that precociousness had a shelf life. It's the rare first novel I wrote at age 25, praised by critics as exceptional writing for a man of 41. Well, as it turned out, I published my first novel almost 20 years later at age 44. And sure enough, none of the reviews mention my age.
One day you turn around and it's summer. Next day you turn around and it's fall.
I just heard this song at Twyla Tharp's new show on Broadway, which consists entirely of Frank Sinatra tunes, and I thought, wow, I never really realized before how profound Sinatra is. What constitutes young and old are somewhat subjective, but as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, old age is 15 years older than I am. But officially, youth ends at 35. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, middle age runs from 35 to 54. Although the popular consensus seems to extend middle age to 60, and even 65 in some cases. But seriously, what does the end of youth mean? What I think is this. It comes when you finally, truly, viscerally realize that you're going to die. Which, if you're lucky, leads to the understanding that life really isn't a rehearsal and makes you start taking life seriously instead of just taking yourself seriously. By the time I saw Stoppard's The Real Thing a second time on Broadway at the beginning of this century, I had a 25-year career as a writer and a 20-year-old marriage and a couple of almost teenage daughters, and I was absolutely blown away by the play this time. Finally, I was old enough to get it. I was mature.
The golden warm September of my
As Tom Stoppard himself has said, age is a very high price to pay for maturity. A high price, sure, but you get what you pay for. My guests today are three creative people who were acclaimed as young people, and each has done great work embodying and defining youth. The actor Martha Plimpton, the writer Juno Diaz, and the musician Josh Ritter. They are all Gen Xers, aged 33 to 41, no longer kids, unless they disagree later. And each, I think, probably has his or her own story about becoming a full-fledged grown-up. My first guest grew up performing and by her teens was memorably in movies like The Mosquito Coast, Goonies, and Running on Empty. More recently, she has become a Broadway star, earning three consecutive Tony nominations, one of them for her role in The Coast of Utopia by Tom Stoppard. This season, she is completely ubiquitous on television, appearing in three different shows at least. Please welcome Martha Plimpton. So in January, you sold out a room in Lincoln Center with your own night of songs and stories. So this is a whole other career you have.
That's correct. I did. Well, I did it with some help from some very good friends, including Dan Lipton, who's playing piano here with me tonight. But yeah, very surprisingly, we did rather well.
Have you been singing since you were a child as well?
Yes. I have been singing in front of the television turned off, which makes a very convenient mirror in the living room. I mean, I did it in front of people a little bit when I was younger, but I didn't like that so much. I didn't like the pressure, really, and so I laid off of it for a lot of years.
But you thought you could do it for real on stage in front of paying customers?
No, not really. Oh. Someone else thought I could, and since I'm, you know, not really one to turn down a challenge, I thought I'd do it.
Well, I think you can. So
well,
will
thanks.
You? Will you? Now?
Oh, okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, Martha Plimpton.
Roll down your window and let the wind blow back your hair.
trading these wings on some wheels, climbing back, heaven's waiting down on the tracks. Oh, come take my hand, we're riding out tonight to case the promised land. Oh, Thunder Road, oh, Thunder Road, lying out there like a killer in the sun. Hey, I know it's late, but we can't make it if we run. Oh, Thunder Road, sit tight, take hope. That I ain't spoke, but tonight we'll be free. All the promises will be broken. There were ghosts in the eyes of all the boys you sent away. They hope this dusty beach road in the skeleton frames of burned out Chevrolets. Scream your name at night in the streets. Your graduation gown lies in rags at their feet. And in the lonely cool before dawn, you hear their engines roaring on. But when you get to the porch, they're gone on the wind. So merry climbing. It's a town full of losers. I'm pulling out of here to win.
That was Martha Plimpton singing Thunder Road with the Lady Boss, with Whistler Eric Gilliland and Dan Lipton on piano. Really, really wonderful.
Thank you.
And I didn't miss the horns or drums.
You know, actually, Bruce Springsteen, of course, does a live sort of quiet ballad version of this song, and you know, I'd grown up listening to that album and to the, you know, original recording, obviously, but until I heard that live version of him doing it, I never really heard it. You know, I mean, I knew what it was about, I knew the feeling it gave me, I knew it was about getting a girl to get in a car and take off, but the sweetness in it I didn't quite get.
Yeah. And the Whistler, a great idea. Do you take a Whistler with you everywhere you go now?
Yeah, he's my. I travel with my Whistler.
Good.
Yeah, it's Eric Gilliland, my own personal Whistler. Yeah.
Right. You really did grow up with it, because it was five. You were five, rather, when he first sang it.
That's right. My babysitter at the time was obsessed and in love with Bruce, and she listened to him constantly, of course, on LP. And every time I was at her house falling asleep, I was listening to that record.
Do you remember the moment, I mean, this song is about what we're talking about a lot tonight. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the moment when you felt like, nah, I'm no longer a kid?
Oh, that's a tough question to ask somebody who's been in show business since they were eight, Kurt. I mean...
So eight, I guess, is the answer, right?
I remember there was a moment. I spent a lot of time looking in the mirror. I don't know how many of you share this habit, but when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time talking to the mirror. I was an only child, and I grew up in the theater, and so a lot of my time was spent talking to myself into the mirror. And there was one time when I was doing this, probably singing or dancing or I don't know what the heck I was doing, and suddenly I caught my own eye and thought, that's me. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was very, very disconcerting. Yeah. And it was like the moment when you first recognize that you're a person. It's a strange sort of sensation. But I consider that a tremendously sad moment of loss.
That really wasn't a moment where you said, give me the grease paint.
No, it wasn't. No, because I think it was actually the opposite. I think what I was doing was saying, give me the grease paint. Oh my God, who am I?
Right.
But this was a moment of being purely inside myself and acknowledging my wholeness. I don't know how else to describe it. It sounds really pretentious. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. But it is public radio. Yeah.
A few years ago, you were quoted as saying, I'm going to do one thing a year that terrifies me. And I couldn't agree with that more as an MO, truly. Mm-hmm. But how's that gone for you?
So far, my record's pretty good.
Yeah?
Tonight's a good example of that.
Yeah?
I like to keep upping the ante. I don't know what's next.
Well, that was going to be my next question. What's next, Martha? What are you working on? What's going to be the rest of the year?
Well, right now I've been, like you mentioned, thank you very much, I've been doing a lot of television because I figured one of the few things that scares me that I haven't done in recent years is make money. So I thought maybe I'd try my hand at that and see if I couldn't accomplish my goal.
Martha Plimpton, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt. Thank you.
But don't go away. This is an applause-crazy crowd. Coming up, Josh Ritter is 33 years old and just released his 7th album. I also understand he's about to publish a novel, but the question is, can he whistle? I'm Kurt Anderson, and we are live in the Jerome L. Green Performance Space in New York City. This is Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, this is Studio 360, and we are live at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space in New York City. Just before the show began, we asked our live audience here to look into their hearts and answer a question for us. When did you realize that you were really a grown-up? And now, my beautiful assistant, Martha Plimpton, will read some of those answers.
I realized I was a grown-up when I was too old to enroll in space camp. I realized I was a grown-up when one of my students was truly depending on me. I realized I was a grown-up when my parents started asking me for advice. I realized I was a grown-up when most of my mail arrived as bills. I realized I was a grown-up when my 21-year-old son told me his girlfriend was pregnant. I realized I was a grown-up when my nose, ear, and eyebrow hairs became undeniable in their quest to dominate my visage. I realized I was a grown-up when I started wanting kitchen appliances. I relate to that. I realized I was a grown-up when I had to take care of myself when I was ill. I realized I was a grown-up when the aches and pains kicked in. I realized I was a grown-up when I taught my baby brother how to drive. I realized I was a grown-up when I could make my own grits.
Thank you, madam. I think we've invented a new form of poetry. I want to thank all of you grown-ups who shared with us, and thank you, Martha Plimpton.
Thank you again.
My next guest is a young songwriter in the tradition of Paul Simon, Leonard Cohen, and Bob Dylan. His lyrics have always seemed to me wise beyond his years. His new album is called So Runs the World Away. Please welcome Josh Ritter.
Stars up above, directionless and drifting, and somewhere in the dark, with the sirens and the thunder, and around me as I swam, the drifters who'd gone under. Time, love, time, love, time, love, time, love, time, love, time. Love, it's only a change of time. I had a dream last night that rusting far below me, battered hulls and broken hardships, Leviathan and lonely. I was thirsty, so I drank, and though it was salt water, there was something about the way it tasted so familiar. Time, love, time, love, time, love, it's only a change of time, love, time, time, love, it's only a change of time. Clouds I'm hanging, this anchor I'm dragging, sails of memory rip open in silence. We cut through the lowlands, all hands through the salt lands, white caps of memory, confusing and violent. Whoa. I had a dream. When I opened my eyes, your shoulder blade, your spine were shorelines in the moonlight. New worlds for the weary, new lands for the living. I could make it if I tried. I closed my eyes, I kept on swimming. Time, love, time, love, time, love, it's only a change of time, love. Time, time, love, it's only a change in rough seas. They carry me wherever I go. Rough seas, they carry me wherever I go.
Thank you. That was Josh Ritter performing Change of Time off his new album, So Runs the World Away. Josh, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
So you've said, So Runs the World Away marks the beginning of a new period in my life. I'm not a kid anymore. According to the Oliver Wendell Holmes 15-year deal, you are a kid to me. But does this song you just sang reflect that, not being a kid anymore?
I felt like I was a grown-up when I was 8. And
we have a theme going here.
Yeah. That same thing where you feel like you're consistently disabused of the idea that you're either a child or a grown-up, you know?
Uh-huh. So Runs the World Away, that title, is a line from Hamlet that Hamlet delivers. Yeah. What's he talking about?
Well, it's a beautiful scene where he's talking about watching a play. He's talking about, he says that some must watch while some must sleep, so runs the world away. And I loved, it just kind of tripped off the tongue, you know? And it really felt like it described what I was trying to write about this record.
Now, speaking of Hamlet, I guess, in terms of its darkness, I understand you had a fairly dark period yourself before you had begun writing the songs on this record.
Well, it was a moment when there were so many things were going great. You know, I've put out a bunch of records, and I've been really lucky to be a musician who can make a living playing music, and that seems like a miracle. And I had just gotten married. I'd moved to New York. Everything was, yeah, it was an amazing thing. And yet when I sat down to write, I just couldn't write. Nothing came. That's never been something I've ever had a problem with. I always thought, well, if it's not happening now, I just don't have anything to say. But then it just kept not happening, you know.
And then you thought of The Mummy. Talk about that.
I was lying in bed one night, and the garbage trucks in New York are a whole new thing to me. Like, they have, you know, they have parades. They have their own holidays. I don't understand. The bags come out. They're blue. One of them is driving these, an armada of trucks down our street, and like 3:30 in the morning, there'll be like 34 of these. And maybe it was just the position that I was lying in felt very mummy-like or something. But anyway, the story came into my mind, and it was a story about a mummy who falls in love with the archaeologist who kind of revived him. I always really loved the idea of mummies and, the you know, doing everything correctly to get this person to the right place. And I thought that was always really, you know, beautiful.
And it broke your writer's block, that.
Yeah, it did.
Middle of the night thought, thanks to the garbage men of New York.
Yeah, yes. Thank you to them. They deserve a lot.
And that became the song The Curse?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You want to play it?
I would love to.
Great.
That'd be great.
He opens his eyes, falls in love at first sight with the girl in the doorway. What beautiful lines, how full of life after thousands of years. What a face to wake up to. He holds back a sigh, she touches his arm. She dusts off the bed where till now he's been sleeping. Under miles of stone, the dried fig of his heart, under scarab and bone, starts back to its beating. She carries him home in a beautiful boat. He watches the sea from a porthole in stowage. He can hear all she says as she sits by his bed. And one day his lips answer her in her own language. The days quickly pass. He loves making her laugh. The first time he moves, it's her hair that he touches. She asks, are you cursed? He says, I think that I'm cured. Then he talks of the Nile and the girls in bulrushes. Oh. In New York he is late. In a glass-covered case, he pretends he is dead. People crowd round to see him, but each night she comes round, and the two wander down the halls of the tomb that she calls a museum. Often he stops to rest, and less, then it's her that looks tired, staying up asking questions. He learns how to read from the papers that she is writing about him, and he makes corrections. It's his face on her book. More and more come to look. Families from Iowa, Upper West Siders. Then one day it's too much. He decides to get up, and as chaos ensues, he walks outside to find her. She's using a cane, and her face looks too pale, but she's happy to see him. As they walk, he supports her. She asks, are you cursed? But his answer's obscured in a sandstorm of flashbulbs, rowdy reporters. Such reanimation, the two tour the nation. He gets out of limos, he meets other women. He speaks of her fondly, their nights in the museum. But she's just one more rag now, he's dragging behind him. She stops going out, she just lies there in bed, in hotels and whatever towns they are speaking. Then her face starts to set, and her hands start to fold, and one day the dried fig of her heart stops its beating. Long ago on the ship, she asked why pyramids. He said, think of the mass, an immense invitation. She asked, are you cursed? He said, I think that I'm cured. Then he kissed her and hoped that she'd forget that question.
Was Josh Ritter singing The Curse. That should, I mean, have you sold that to Hollywood yet? It's a good story.
They want it.
And I was joking. I'm talking with Josh Ritter. We're going to take a quick break. And in a minute, the writer Juno Diaz will join us. I'm Kurt Anderson. We're live in the green space in New York City. This is Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360, and we are live in WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space. I'm here with the musician Josh Ritter, and now I would like to invite to the stage my next guest, who's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his first novel, The Wonderful, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. Please welcome Junot Diaz. Now, one of the reasons I didn't want Josh to leave the stage just yet, because I want to have a little literary symposium here. Josh, I understand you're not just a songwriter, but as I mentioned, you have a novel, your first novel, coming out next year.
Yeah.
It's called Bright's Passage. What's it about?
It's about a kid from West Virginia who goes off to the First World War and comes back home with an angel that tells him to do things.
Bad things or good things?
Well, they usually turn out. It's a comedy. It's an angel West Virginian bromance. You know, so.
There's so many of those. Junot, what's the best piece of advice you can give to Josh as he presumably is polishing up this novel?
I guess. First, thanks, Kerr, for having me, and thanks, guys, for being out. And it sounds done, man. So I'm like, what? This cat needs no advice. Oh, man, that song was brilliant, Josh. You condensed the novel right into a song. So I'm like, I think, Kurt, he's straight.
Yeah.
I think he's completely fine.
Have you ever tried writing songs, Junot?
No.
No?
Yeah, I find fiction like difficult enough, you know. So
well, I don't think any fiction writer would disagree with you. And I wonder, Josh, did you reach a point where you thought, "What the hell am I doing in the middle?"
I reached a point where I finished the first draft and I thought it was like the greatest book ever written.
Uh oh.
And then I gave it to somebody and I just realized how terrible it was. I'd never been through that before. And like, there's a lot more words in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when it comes out, will you come back on the show and talk about it?
I would love to.
Great.
I would love to. Thank you.
Josh Ritter's novel comes out, I believe, in the summer of 2011, and his new album, So Runs the World Away, is out right now. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, everybody. Thanks.
So, Mr. Diaz, you teach creative writing at MIT as well as writing great books and stories.
Yes, I'm with the big nerds. I like them a lot.
Well, what is that like? I mean, I don't imagine MIT students as, necessarily your literary humanistic types. What's it like teaching these engineers and physicists and super geeks?
You know how it is. I mean, if there was like a rowboat, the first person who gets thrown to hell off, or a lifeboat, you know? The doctor looks at the lawyer looks at the politician, and they're all like, throw that damn artist off. You know? So I think whether it's
MIT. And that's how these MIT guys feel about you?
No, I just think that they're real typical Americans. If you're an artist and you support the art and you think it's absolutely essential for like a human condition, you're going in there swinging because they've been taught that art is kind of whack. And then if you do your job right, by the end, there's like, one of every 50 engineers, they're like, forget it, I'm gonna write my damn mummy novel, you know? They're like, yes, yeah. Yes, I love you, you know? Yeah.
The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde is about this geeky Dominican kid growing up in New Jersey who loves sci-fi and comic books. Is that a point of connection to these kids?
It wasn't so much a point of connection because my young people didn't know what the hell I was writing. They didn't know I was writing about nerds, and they probably would have thought I was kidding anyway, you know? So I like it better when years later they come send me an email and they're like, dude, you write? You know? that's when you know you've done your job right. You kind of erased yourself, you know? It's perfect.
Well, they may not be interested in what you've written, but I am. Could you read an excerpt from Oscar Wilde and maybe set up?
Yeah,
you're gonna
this is about this young Dominican girl in Paterson, New Jersey, and It's the opening of a chapter in a novel called Wildwood. Yeah, and I'm only going to read a piece of it, and then that'll be that. Yeah, it's, Wildwood. It's never the changes we want that change everything. This is how it all starts, with your mother calling you into the bathroom. You will remember what you were doing at that precise moment for the rest of your life. You were reading Watership Down, and the rabbits were making their dash for the boat, and you did not want to stop reading. But then your mother called again, louder, her "I am not f***ing around" voice, and you mumbled irritably, "Sí, señora." Your mother was standing in front of the medicine and cabinet mirror, naked from the waist up, her bra slung around her like a torn sail, the scar on her back as vast and inconsolable as a sea. You want to return to your book to pretend that you had not heard her, but it is too late. Her eyes meet yours, the same big, smoky eyes that you will have in the future. "Ven acá," she commands. She is frowning at something on one of her breasts. For the record, your mother's breasts are immensities, one of the wonders of the world. The only ones that you've seen that are bigger are in nudie magazines or on really fat ladies. They are 36 triple D's, and the areolas are as big as saucers and as black as pitch. And at their edges are fierce little hairs that sometimes your mother plucks and sometimes she does not. These breasts have always embarrassed you, and when you walk in public with her, you are always conscious of them. After her face and her hair, her chest is what she is most proud of. Your father, your mother likes to brag, could never get enough of these. But given the fact that he ran off on her in her third year of marriage, it seemed in the end he could, yeah? You dread conversations with your mother, those one-sided dressing downs. You have figured that your mother has called you into the bathroom to give you another earful about your diet. Your mother's convinced that if you eat more plátanos, you will suddenly acquire her same extraordinary train-wrecking secondary sex characteristics. Even at that age, you were nothing if not your mother's daughter. You were 12 years old and already as tall as she was, a long, slender-necked ibis of a girl. You had her green eyes, clearer though, and her straight hair, which makes you look more Hindu than Dominican, and a behind that the boys have not been able to stop talking about since the fifth grade, but whose appeal you do not yet understand. You have her complexion, too, which means that you are dark. But for all of your similarities, the tides of inheritance have yet to reach your chest. You have only the slightest hint of breast. From most angle, you are as flat as a board, and you are thinking that your mother's going to order you to stop wearing bras again, because in her words, they are suffocating your potential breast, discouraging them from developing. You are ready to argue with your mother to the death because you are as possessive of your new bras as you are of the pads that you can now buy yourself. Yeah, that's long enough.
That was...
Thank you.
That was Juno Diaz reading from his novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. That passage is, for those who don't remember or haven't read the book, is from the point of view of Oscar's smart older sister, Lola, right?
Yeah, yeah. Breast cancer is in the offing in the next page.
And oh, you're harshing my mellow, as we used to say.
I knew it.
No. But... it's interesting, the fact that it's in second person really makes it funnier, doesn't it? If she was just saying, I this, it wouldn't be as funny, would it?
Well, you know the deal with second person. Second person creates this repulsive intimacy, you know? Because most of us grow up with our parents saying you, and half the time we want to knock them the hell out because the you form is like kind of abrasive, but it's also real intimate, you know? You walk by a cop and dude says you, everyone near him is going to look.
Yeah.
And as a writer, you're always looking for ways to draw people in, but at the same time to make them aware that, you know, they're being drawn in, because you want your audience, at least I do, to resist you as much as to be kind of drawn in, because in that moment you get much more human reaction. I mean, as an artist, if you want people just to like you, There's 1,000 other careers for that.
And you in that passage and elsewhere in the rest of the book, you write from this girl's point of view very convincingly. And it made me think of that when I saw you in this great YouTube video on stage with four women reading letters to Judy Blum at an anti-censorship yes. benefit. And Martha Plimpton was there as well. I wonder how you ended up being on the one guy on that stage with those women reading Judy Blum.
You know, you know, I don't give a damn. I think if Judy Blum wrote you an email, be like, show up because we're raising funds, your ass is going to be there, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe I was like the fourth dude who turned, but I was like, yeah, yes, Judy. You know? So I showed up, you know.
Did you ever read her as a kid?
Well, yeah, I have two sisters, man, and we're like almost the same age. So, of course, because you're a teenage boy, you're thinking, oh, my sister's reading this. This is going to be a map for
I can learn
future
something.
Conquest, yeah, you know? Yeah. You're a dude, man. What the hell you want?
I read that you basically finished Oscar Wilde when you were barely 30, but you didn't publish it until you were almost 40. Did you feel as though you started it when you were young and finished it when you were an adult?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, a real piece of art, I assume, having only produced two, with such knowledge, basically the book is asking for you to become the person that you need to be to write the damn thing. It is asking you to be transformed in the process. The book wanted me to be a better person than I was when I started out. And I think that was harder than any of the sentences or any of the practical kind of literary concerns.
Beautifully said.
Growing up, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but that's my... Those are, yeah. The people who started crap and they're from like New Jersey, you know? Oh, I knew it.
Now, not just Oscar Wilde, but a lot of your fiction is about young people. And as a person now over 40... Do you feel like you're going to stick with writing about kids?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, part of it is that I have like kind of a 15-year lag. It's kind of like light coming from Alpha Centauri. I'm still kind of at 25, you know? So I think I probably, as it goes along, I mean, I'll age up my characters because that's the way it works.
But they'll be 15 years younger.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a 25, like I said.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about young people is that, you know, it's like, especially if you're an immigrant kid like me, I was asked to translate for my parents. I was asked to arbitrate for my parents. I was asked to, like, write letters to the super. I was asked to, like, be the front person in the world of English. And so in parts, you're never a child as an immigrant. In parts, you're being asked to be an adult. This confusion follows us into our adulthood.
Are you working on a big thing now?
Yes. Trying to write a new novel, which is like incredibly difficult.
Really? So how many years do we have to wait?
Smoke them if you got them, bro.
Yeah. Okay.
Smoke them if you got them. Yeah.
Gino Diaz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kirk. Thank you so much.
And I'd like to thank all the rest of my amazing guests tonight, Martha Plimpton and Josh Ritter. Thank you so much. You can listen to the show as well as watch videos of every minute of it at our website, studio360.org. And that is it, I'm afraid, for this week's special live edition of Studio 360. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much for listening.
River wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Oh, dream maker.
Speaking of youth and midlife, do any of you out there happen to be Harley Davidson riders, past or present? We're looking for your stories about the motorcycle for our American Icon series. If you have some, contact us through our website, studio360.org. Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Special thanks this week to Indira Etwaru, Nikki Johnson, Gil Schuster, Ricardo Fernandez, and the entire Greenspace team. Studio 360's production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Aaron Calabria,
Jess Jiao,
Michael Guerriero,
Carrie Barber,
John Delore, and George Wellington were our engineers, and our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
Drifters off to see the world. There's such a lot of world to see. We're both looking for.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Fly me to the moon.
Next time in Studio 360, the master choreographer Twyla Tharp dances to Frank Sinatra on Broadway.
Partially it's a pun, which I love to do. Fly me to the moon. Okay, let's fly this girl. So we toss her and turn her and we swoop her and we swing her.
Twyla Tharp and Sinatra, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. In other words.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.